On this episode of Never Surrender.
I often think about these performances as ways to maybe like build a tougher shell or something. Like if I know the hardest thing that I can imagine, like standing still for 3 months, 9 hours a day, then whatever life throws at me next, I'll be like totally prepared for it.
So is that part of it then, trying to see like how much your mind and body can withstand?
Yeah, because being alive is fucking hard, you know? Mm-hmm. It's really tough. And so if I can kind of like keep pushing this line to what like I can survive, then I'll be golden.
I'm Jack Hergith.
And I'm Stephen Kramer Glickman.
And this is Never Surrender,
the show where we sit down with the most successful people in the entertainment industry to talk about failure and how they pushed through it and never gave up.
Because we've all failed. We've all had setbacks.
Yeah, we've all questioned whether to keep going.
But at some point, everybody struggles.
Yeah, I mean, I've been let go from some of my favorite jobs.
You and me both. We just hope that by listening to this podcast, it will help give you the strength to never surrender.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Our guest today is a performance artist whose art has been featured in exhibitions all around the world, from LA to New York to Paris. And he's received a number of recognitions and awards for his work.
He's known to test the limits of his body to produce thought-provoking pieces. Through his art, he's tackled issues of race, gender, and sexuality.
His art is an honest presentation of how he struggled, continues to struggle, and how he faces those challenges.
This is E.J. Hill. E.J. Hill, thank you so much for being here, man.
Thank you for having me.
It is
our pleasure.
Yeah, it really is. It's so cool. You know, getting to sit down with an artist like, you know, like yourself, a performance artist and a painter, sculptor. I mean, you are, and you do installations. And you're very well loved in the art community.
Am I? That's cool. I hope so.
That's gotta feel good. Do you have a lot of artist friends? Do you have other people that are artists that you hang out with and check out their stuff, or do you kind of prefer to be the only one in the group?
I couldn't actually do any of this if I didn't have people with me and beside me who actually understand what it feels like to, I don't know, it's a weird life, you know? I wasn't ever expecting to be an artist, or let alone an artist who is kind of like doing it as a career, you know, like a livelihood, like a thing it's like my job at this point, which is dope. So if I didn't have other people around me, I wouldn't be able to do this. Yeah, I don't want to be the only one.
Were you interested in art as a kid? Like, were there things about art that interested you at that time? Or
I talking to older cousins and aunts and uncles, they would always say that I was a creative kid, but no one had ever used the word artistic, and I didn't even know, like, my knowledge of art stopped at, you know, watercolors, basically.
That's where mine stops,
you know, like the stuff that hangs in like waiting room offices.
Sure.
So that was what art was to me. So I never imagined that I could do anything within the realm of art as an adult. So I would say no. Like, I like to sing when I was younger, and I like to do things, like make stuff with my hands, but I never really thought about it as like capital A, like high art, you know, contemporary art.
Yeah, because when I was a kid, like, my idea of art was, remember in the back of those magazines, they would have like, draw this turtle or draw this bird. Like,
Then you can get into art school.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
What they would say.
Yeah, draw Petey or Timmy or, you know, yeah, whatever. And
it's
I'm like,
a bear
oh, okay.
or something. Draw this bear and then you can get into art school.
I was like, oh, I can do that. I can be an artist. I can draw this turtle. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. When I was a kid, I used to do little stop motion videos. That's
nice.
What I thought was like the I didn't know how far anything like that could go, but I did like to draw and then try to make flip books, things like that, you know, like
word.
I thought that was all really cool. And I wasn't really introduced into like big, you know, like artists and I mean, I think, you know, as a kid you're like, oh, Michelangelo and mm-hmm. stuff like this, but it's mostly because of the Ninja Turtles. But then, you don't really know that much about it. What was like the first artist that the first work that you saw as a kid that you were like, oh, this speaks to me, like this is important to me?
I didn't really see or encounter any art until I got to art school, which was a total gamble. Someone, you know, my first art mentor was this woman, Margaret Nomentano, who worked at this summer camp in Maine that I worked at. And
how old were you when you were at that camp?
I think I was like a junior counselor, so I was about maybe 19, I think.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Like 19 or 20.
And this was like a regular summer camp for kids to go to?
Yeah, this was a camp in Maine, or it was kind of, you know, that region. New England is kind of known for having these, like, you know, camps where children of wealthy parents can go, like, canoe and water ski for a summer. But this camp was, like, specifically for children of Maine. So it was, like, tuition free. You had to be referred to the camp by a guidance counselor or school therapist or something like that. So it was for you know, kids from lower income families. And so we had this drawing workshop, and we were going to pilot an arts education program one summer. And so they brought in a local artist to do like a week long drawing workshop with the oldest campers, which were about 15, 16. And I was supposed to be her assistant for the week. And that's how I kind of got introduced to this thing called art, and she suggested I go to an art school, and I was like,
what was it of your work that she saw that kind of, like, where do you think she came up with that idea?
I think it was, so while she was offering, you know, the drawing lessons to the you know, older kids, I was sort of at their side drawing with them and like really getting excited about this thing. And I think that's when she saw a light bulb. And so I was, again, like 19 or 20 at this time. I had no college ambition. I just wanted to like hang out in the woods and like work at camps and after school programs. And she maybe saw that these lessons kind of like, you know, jolted something in me. So she suggested I might, you know, maybe look into going to art school.
So before this, you weren't sure what you wanted to do?
No, I kind of knew that I wanted to work within spheres of education, but not in the 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. classroom setting. But, you know, alternative ed, summer camps, after school programs, outward bound trips, like places where you're still learning and you get to work with youth, but you're not like confined to a desk and
sure.
regulated by a bell.
I get that. I mean, when I graduated from high school, I did not want to go to like a regular university, and it was you know, I was not good at math, you mm-hmm. know, and like things, and I was like, oh, I have to go to like a university and be stuck in classes
right.
with like 200, 400 people or whatever. Like, it all seemed ridiculous. And then I went to like an acting conservatory
nice.
And like to like check it out, and I was like, they're just doing everything already.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like they're already doing all the stuff that I would love to do.
Exactly.
It's got to kind of feel like that, you know?
Well, yeah, because at that point, by the time, you know, you're 18, you've been in school for what, like 13 years, and it's been like the same exact thing every year. There's like no,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, sure, there are things like sort of like Waldorf schools or something, but...
Right.
But
most people are going to like
right.
social studies and
right.
then this and history and whatever.
And after that, like, I couldn't bear to think of like another second of something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I was like, maybe college just isn't for me. This isn't the life that like, I can't do this.
Did you feel any pressure from your parents? Because I've had friends of mine who are first generation Americans and
mm-hmm.
their parents emigrated from Belize.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, my friends who had parents who had immigrated had a lot of pressure put on them to be you know, a success. Like, you need to be a doctor.
Yeah.
You need to be a lawyer. You need to be a professional. And my friend, I've told this before, just wanted to get into radio. And they were like, no, you need to be a doctor first, and then you can do radio.
Right.
So
right.
I'm just curious, like, is that something that you face with your
And his
your
name
parents?
Was Dr. Drew.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Dr. Oz is his name.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think my mom was the one who was kind of like, you need like a, you know, quote unquote, real job. You should go to college, get a good job, like that whole thing. So I was very, very pressured by her because, again, no one in the family had ever pursued anything like this. And even when my dad attempted to pursue, it was just something that he kind of like put on the back burner because he had to like support a family, you know. So there was, yeah, there was a lot of pressure, mostly from my mom to kind of like go a traditional route. And I think she has only recently come around within the last few years as she sees that like me lifting a bunch of stuff in the garage and getting messy with materials like is now starting to pay for a life that is like taking me away from like relying on her for stuff, you know?
Yeah, yeah, of course.
So it's been kind of cool to see this flip, you know?
Let's go back to early performance.
Yeah.
Work. What are you doing? What's the? Because I've seen what you've been doing.
Yeah.
Other, like more currently, but what are some of the early stuff?
So one of the earliest ones. I mean, you know, in I again with a limited knowledge of art, getting there, and they're teaching, you know, stuff from the '60s, like Chris Burden or Carolee Schneeman or all of these people who are using their bodies as material. We're watching, like, every other week there's some nude body on some like projection. I think you know, like the Carolee Schneeman Meat Joy piece. There's maybe like 16 upwards to like 20 people rolling around in like chicken and fish and raw meat and just rolling around this like warehouse space as an art performance. And so if this is kind of what I'm being trained in, my first one, I was like, well, yeah, all right. So I'm going to be nude in performances almost every time. So whether I was like shaving my entire body from like head to toe or like dragging myself through a field or something, it was always really aggressive. And oftentimes I was wearing no clothes. And so my mom, I remember one day seeing something, or maybe one of her friends or family members sent a write-up from one of these performances, and I'm nude in one of the photos, and she's like, hey, I saw, you know, this art piece that you did. Can you take that down? I don't really like it. And so I was like, Mom, that's not how the internet works. That's there.
Let me call the
wow.
internet.
Yeah.
And tell them to take it down.
Yeah. Sure, of course.
Hello, internet.
Yeah.
Take this down, please.
Yeah.
My mom hates it. Yeah.
Well, what was that like, though? Like, if you're like, okay, I'm going to shave my whole body from head to toe.
Yeah. Have you ever been naked in front of a lot of people before?
I mean, like, how deep are we getting?
get deep, baby.
Yeah, get
deep,
baby.
I mean, yeah, but not in a professional context, you know?
Okay, but you weren't, were you, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being like, this is the most uncomfortable thing in the history of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was on a TV show, and mm-hmm. they needed me to strip down to my underwear
mm-hmm.
And then cuddle a man in bed.
Yeah, that sounds great.
It was, yeah, but it was the first time I'd ever been in my underwear on television, mm-hmm. and I was like, and I'm a fat guy, and I was like very, very nervous about like how I was gonna look, and I'm like trying to hold my stomach. But even then, you can see I'm like a big guy, and it was I would say like out of 10, being 10 the most scariest mm-hmm. ever, I was probably at about an 8, 7,
nice.
7 or 8.
That's not, yeah.
So
that's
I was like
not
trying to be, I was trying to be confident, but also it's like, it's nerve wracking. For you, the first time you were in front of like a full crowd full of people doing mm-hmm. an art piece and you were naked, where were you in the fear spectre?
I would say around, yeah, like a 7-ish as well, you yeah. know, because I think that the audiences that I was performing for at that time were also trained, and you know, we were all looking at the same stuff and the same art historical context. We were all like learning together, so it wasn't It wasn't for audiences who were like new to my peers, the people in my classes and people immediately surrounding the art school that I was attending. I think I was more afraid of my family finding out.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when they did, it was kind of like this unspoken thing. Like my mom was the only one who like brought it up. Wow. But I feel like nude performances is, you know, it's like a trope in performance art. It's kind of like the gateway drug or something. You gotta like... Right.
Of the stuff that you did in your early works, do you have a favorite? Like a favorite thing that you did?
Yeah, I do have... So there's one... I was doing this residency in Wisconsin, and we're driving into the town, and there's this banner that's like, next weekend, you know, Civil War reenactment weekend. And I was just like, wait,
woohoo! Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, that sounds great.
I think it was called Musket... It was like the, you know... like 86th annual like Muskets and Memories weekend or something.
Oh, I
and
love so, that weekend. It's so, one of my favorites.
Yeah.
So I'm like driving into this town and I'm just like, what, where am I? Like, this is going to be a really difficult 2 weeks, I think. Like, this is how I'm entering the town on this like, you know, tiny road, this two-way road. And so I decide if I'm going to be in this town for 2 weeks and they're getting ready for this huge event, in order for me to settle and sleep nicely, I have to go engage. Like, I have to just like see what it's about and like be here. And so I went down, I think on the second day, and wore like a dress shirt and nice slacks and a little tiny American flag pin, and then just like dragged my body using only my arms through the Confederate camp, like across the field.
Geez.
And that was like one of my favorite pieces, because the reaction from, you know, I'm inserting myself into this situation where it's been planned and organized and thought about, and I'm just going as like the rupture point, I guess, a little bit.
Sure.
Wow.
And so that, I think, in terms of the fear that you were asking about earlier, like that was one of the I was afraid that I was going to get like assaulted.
Yeah,
so,
I don't blame you. That's
that one had my heart racing for a while, but then after I made it across the field, you know, relatively unscathed, I think it's one of the more sort of like emotionally, psychically rewarding pieces.
And what kind of reaction were you getting from these people?
I had a few people in attendance who were like, are you okay, man? Like, do you need water? Because I didn't anticipate how it would look to people, but people thought I was like actually hurt and struggling or maybe like having a heart attack or something. And then other people, there's this one part where my friend was videotaping, documenting for me. There's one part where EMS services like come and you can hear the engine idling out of frame. And then they just kind of drive around me without ever saying a word. And that was like a really kind of beautiful and dark moment.
One thing that I know that we've heard a little bit about is that you take breaks from doing big performance art.
Mm-hmm.
And in the breaks, you'll paint. Mm-hmm. And stuff, and do other things to kind of
mostly cry, but
mostly, you know. Cry. Sure, of course. Now that's a real thing. Like, you know, I saw some pictures of you at one of the universities where you were standing all day, and mm-hmm. it's like a piece. That's basically the piece, is that you're standing on a podium,
mm-hmm.
right? And then there was like a track and field kind of built around it with photographs of you running around the campus,
mm-hmm.
right? And then then you stood on this podium. How long did you stand on the podium for without getting off?
I was on the podium every hour the museum was open to the public. So from Tuesday to Sunday, I only had one day off. Tuesdays through Friday were about like 9 hours, I think. And then Saturday and Sunday, I believe, were 6 hours.
Okay, so for 9 hours, mm-hmm. you're standing without moving.
Pretty much, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What do you do about the bathroom, about things like that? What do you do?
I was fasting the entire summer for 3 months. I would wake up and I would drink one glass of water at the latest. I would have maybe two glasses, but I would have my last sip maybe 2 hours prior to standing on the podium. So I would be able to take care of everything. And then I wouldn't eat until I got home around like 9 o'clock that night.
Wow.
And then how is your body reacting to you, you know, standing on a podium for 9 hours a day, several days a week? Like,
My knees and my lower back were, and a lot of the time my upper back toward the end of the summer were just like on fire. It was really painful.
Oh, I can't imagine.
And yeah. Then months after would still have like pain in my back.
So you really are like the living definition of it. Of a tortured artist. Like you seem to, I mean, just looking at your work and you know, seeing some of the videos and what you've done, like it seems like you really go to the full extreme of not abusing your body, but doing things.
Pushing it
to the limit where you're, you know, jumping rope for several hours on end. And you know,
did you wear special shoes?
I had some insoles, yeah, okay, inside the shoes, yeah.
Or, you know, that piece you did when you were going around licking a wall.
Right.
Until your tongue started bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then the you know, piece you did with a roller coaster, and you're lying there.
Right.
Motionless for several hours a day.
Yeah,
it's
that
like
was
how,
another
I mean,
month.
What... I guess the question is, like, you know, are you concerned about, you know, taking it to the limit with your body? Do you mind it? Are you just trying to push boundaries? I mean, are you concerned about hurting yourself?
Yeah, I am actually concerned about going too far. I had, again, a professor in undergrad pull me aside after one performance and tell me, he's like, you know, it'd be irresponsible of me if I didn't let you know that this type of work that you're interested in and this type of performance that you're pursuing, it has a line. And he offered that some artists who kind of go down this path, they find their line and then they step away and, like, you know, maybe turn to painting or something else that is a little more sustainable. And then he let me know that other artists, when they find their line, they cross it, and mm-hmm. That's it, you know? And so he's like, I have to let you know that, like, this path is something that many people have gone down before, but just be careful. And so that really stuck with me. And he hasn't been the only person to offer that to me over the years. I think sometimes these things get, like, I do get a little bit too close to a line. And for people who, you know, who care about me, I see that they're concerned. I go into them not for shock value or not to just kind of like, you know, be this guy who's trying to like get a rise out of people. But I often think about these performances as ways to maybe like build a tougher shell or something. Like if I know the hardest thing that I can imagine, like standing still for 3 months, 9 hours a day, then whatever life throws at me next, I'll be like totally prepared for, because this seemingly impossible task has now created a new line for what my mind and body can withstand. And it was under my control. I set the parameters. So the next time something comes along that I don't have control over, I know that I'll be able to hang on. So
is that part of it then, trying to see like how much your mind and body can withstand?
Yeah, because being alive is fucking hard, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's really tough. And so if I can kind of like keep pushing this line to what like I can survive, then I'll be golden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll be good.
I get that. That makes a lot of sense. Now, after you have something like this happen, you do a big event, you know, what is the following day like when you're done, when you finished the big show? And the big performance art piece. What's the following day like? What do you do on that day?
I'm in bed, if not the whole day, for much of it. And then I'll try to do something maybe a little restorative, like head to the beach or go on a hike or maybe a little vacation somewhere. But just something to kind of... revive, you know,
sure,
come back to life a little bit.
And what do you think sort of pushes you to drive things, to take things to the limit in your performances? I know we talked about this a little bit before, but like, what inside you is just driving you to like
to kind of feel
see
like
how far you can go
mm-hmm.
When you know at the end of it there's going to be emotional pain, there's going to be physical pain, you're really sort of taking yourself through some dark places.
I think these performances I think about for months at a time. So upward to a year, I'm mulling something over. And so when something takes over your mind for that long in order to like shake it out, you know, you just got to go through it. Yeah, you got to do it. But I think, you know, to your question, Jack, what like drives me or what's driving these particular types of works, I would say, you know, I'm dealing with like a lot of shit from childhood. And mm-hmm. I think sitting in a therapist's office every week is like cool and like, sure, like mental health. Yeah, let's go for it. Like, let's be like, let's make mental health trendy, like taking care of yourself. Like, let's get that trending. I'm all for it. However, for me, I found sometimes that becomes the thing that sort of like puts thorns in my sides as well. Like my last therapist was like, what do you mean? She's like, when did this happen? Was this in LA? Was this recently? What do you mean? Like black people are being murdered by cops. And I was like, lady, like, are you like, what? Like, where are you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because you're not living in the world that I'm living in, clearly. And so like when I'm going to seek professional help for like all of these things that I feel like are sort of societal daggers being like thrown my way, when I go to the person who's supposed to, you know, help with this and they then become another blade, I know that like I have to figure out not an alternative but a supplement to that, you know, a supplement to the doctors and the therapists. And this is sort of my way of saying, well, if I'm going to be alive in this world and if I'm going to have to deal with like all of these things that are very specific to my body and my person within this sort of social sphere,
sure,
then let's really do it. And then I'm going to invite people to do it with me, because this isn't just my shit, this isn't just my problem, this is like all of our deals. And so if we can kind of like deal or encounter these feelings that might be tough to watch or tough to listen to, tough to grapple with, maybe I can help you help me help all of us kind of move out of it and find something a little lighter.
Right. And I think that goes back to that quote you had in your lecture where you talked about when life gives you lemons, struggle in public,
yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
So is that part of it too? Like, just taking all of your stuff that you're dealing with and like that is really sort of your therapy in a sense too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You have to, if you're not airing what it is that's kind of dragging you down, then I mean basically it's just like asking for help. I mean, which is one of the hardest things to do.
Sure.
But in order to ask for help, it has to like be a public thing. You have to make at least one other person outside of yourself aware of what's going on.
A lot more to come with E.J. Hill when we come back.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
That's such a true thing. When you, I know that you're doing that publicly with you know, inviting people in to watch you perform and have a performance piece that that lets you handle things like that. But when you are going through depression or you are going through like a hard time, do you have friends that you reach out to as well and let them know that you're going through a hard time, or do you just do it in the performance art?
Yeah, no, I have people, friends and family that I go to, and the performances, they're not always coming from that place, but they, you know, it's definitely part of it. And I do know that there's, you know, there's criticism of this type of practice where people are just like, dude, like, I don't want to help you carry any of this. This isn't my problem. Like, be an adult, get a hang of your own stuff, get a handle on it. And so it's often seen as like, you know, part of the criticism is that it's like narcissistic, or it's like putting a burden on like someone else. And I, at this point, I try not to listen to any of that, because I hope it's, my sincere hope is actually that it's not about me, mm-hmm. personally. Mm. It starts here. It starts from a position of I, the individual. But when I'm talking about like particular bodies that I think struggle, a narrative of struggle is something that many different types of people can connect to. And I speak from Black, I speak from queer because that's my experience. But I think there are a lot of crossovers in the bodies that we live in, the bodies that house us in public.
Yeah. Is there a piece or something that you want to do in the future, but you're not ready to do it yet? Like, do you have something kind of in the back of your mind? Like, oh, I want to try this out, but you're just not ready to do it yet.
So something I haven't been able to do yet, and I am ready for it. I just have to figure out how logistically this would work. But I would love to see like a 50-foot long, or maybe even like, I don't know, let's go 50 yards. Let's go big, you know, a swing set of people trying to synchronize the swing so that all, you know, 150, however many people you can fit on this thing, are swinging in tandem. And for that tiny moment of like bliss that can only last a fraction of a second when like all of these people are swinging together, wouldn't that be crazy?
Cool.
And really then like
cool.
How to sort of engage your body in a way and understand who's next to you to try to, and it's something that happens without touch. So you have to kind of be conscious of like your rhythms and the rhythms of the people next to you just to try to get that like fraction of a second where you can like all just be together. I think that would be so beautiful.
Very cool.
I want to choreograph something like that.
I love that.
I love
idea.
It. I love it. Do it. I remember just watching that video of you at UCLA and, you know, screaming. And when you were done, this woman kind of looks at the camera like, wow, what the hell was that about?
Right.
I'm curious, like, what's like the weirdest reactions like you're getting from people? Like, do you get like just crazy reactions sometimes, or people like, I don't know what that's about, and like walk out? Or I'm just curious, like, as you know, as to what sort of reactions you get from some people.
So the performance at the Hammer, I was there. So, you know, people were like, oh, like, I wonder, like, how people are reacting to this. Like, as an artist, you always are kind of curious about what your audience is engaging with and how. I got to be, you know, there, like, fly on the wall the whole time. So I had a range of experiences. There were people who would come in and be really moved and cry in that room. And I remember this one couple comes in, and within seconds, the guy turns to who I assume was his wife, and he goes, do you get it? She's like, no. And then they immediately leave. And so they're like,
oh, that's great.
It was like they didn't spend any time with anything. And then there were people who came in who would spend like a whole hour in that room in silence. But yeah, some people, you know, there, some people just aren't into it, and that's fine.
Right. Have you ever had a piece go wrong that you're working on?
Yeah. This is so weird. I was thinking about this morning, actually. I was thinking about this work where it worked in the context of like a grad school critique. I got up during what was supposed to be my time to have my work discussed, and I just peed on myself and stood there in a puddle of my own urine. And no one, I think my professor said later that she thought I was having a seizure because I just stood there silently, and then other people just like didn't know what to do. They thought it was like some kind of like thing that was happening to me. So again, I'm kind of like looking at the framework of the institution, the situation, and just attempting to obliterate it. So then,
and carpet,
right?
I'm just kidding. No, I'm just
and your pants,
yeah,
right, yeah.
But so someone who worked at a gallery at that time heard about this performance, and then we talked about it, and I was like, yeah, let's do it in the gallery. And at that point, I didn't realize that certain things just don't work in certain situations. You can't just plop something out of its original context and put it in another one and expect it to have the same kind of potency. So I built this little wooden platform, this stage in this gallery, and invited everyone over, like, come on down, like, you know, performance, 8 p.m., it's going to be great. And people show up, and they're all sitting in, like, seats facing this, like, low stage for this, like, performance. And then I go up there, and I kind of, like, you know, get a little nervous, and I like can't pee. So I'm like, shit, I'm like trying to pee and just waiting there, and everyone's just like waiting for something to happen. And then I finally urinate, and then I stand there, and the experiment in my head was like, how, if you set something up in a room, as like a traditional performance, seats in rows facing a stage or a platform, and then do something like this, what would happen? Would someone get up and freak out and like yell, like throw a tomato at the stage? And what I realized is that when you set the conditions, people generally just like follow the rules. And that was kind of a bummer. So I was up there for about 2.5 hours in wet pants, and no one like did or said anything. And then I got so sad and started to cry when I realized that I could be up here forever and no one, not a single person, would like say, hey man, are you okay? Like, is everything all right?
Oh.
And I got super bummed out. So I think that piece just like totally, it wasn't maybe a success for different reasons, but that one still is just like, I could have thought about that differently and done some things to kind of tie that neatly.
And does your mom come to all your shows? And does she give you notes on oh, well, you know, you standing for a long time or urinating in your pants or yeah, or the roller coaster bit? Like, does she go to all your shows and just give you her notes or her impressions? Because I just can see, like, if it was me doing that, my mom would come and be like, oh, well, you know, I'm worried about your shins from yeah, standing so long, or, you know, maybe you shouldn't do this or that. I'm just,
right,
you know, just in a pure mom sense.
Yeah, she's definitely, definitely a mom in that way. It's very rarely notes to where I can improve. It's mostly just like, why don't you just do it for like 2 days, you know,
right,
instead of 3 months? Like, so she definitely has ideas about what shouldn't happen.
Right, of course.
Yeah. Right, right.
Yeah.
I know. This,
well, she's looking out for you.
Yeah,
she's
no, I know.
Mom.
I know.
I'd be doing the same thing with my kids. They were like, oh, you know, maybe you should do it for 2 days or do it for 1 day and see how you feel.
I spoke to my mom this morning and told her about some of the big things that I'm working on coming here to do this, and how I'm very excited, and, you know, your how incredible your work is. And I was like, I'm a big fan of, you know, EJ Hill. I got to meet him and get to sit down with him. And her response was, that's so nice. Have you thought about putting on a production of Fiddler on the Roof at a synagogue in Los Angeles? Because people really like that show. I know you like doing these interviews, but musicals can be. I was like, I got to go. I have to get off the
phone. I love her.
God bless her. She's wonderful.
I wish she would give me that feedback.
Oh, asking you.
Can I sit down with her?
Or? Oh, she'll tell okay, you the same thing.
Okay.
Come on, Jack. We'll
let's arrange a meeting with your mom.
Yeah. Yes, there we go. That's the way to do it.
I want to talk about one of your pieces. And,
please.
And that was the piece you did with your Victory Labs, mm-hmm, where you went around to all these different educational institutions, different schools that you had gone to in LA and had done like Victory Labs,
mm-hmm,
in front of each one. What sort of what inspired you to do that, and how did you feel afterwards?
I was living in New York for a couple years, maybe like a year and a half, I was doing this residency at the Studio Museum in Harlem. And then when I moved back to LA, I wanted to sort of, you know, reinsert myself in this city again and kind of deal with my old ghosts. And so one way to do that was to confront them head on. So I went back to every school that I had attended here. And as someone who, you know, I wasn't really like a good student, traditionally good student. Like I said earlier, I didn't have any college ambition. So to be in this point in my life and my career where things are going well and the work is regarded and written about. And recently, you know, I heard that like some people are like teaching the work in their like college courses. So like to be at this point and then looking back to all of those times in school where like the teachers were just like, what are you doing, kid? Like, you know, like had these ideas for me, but like I could never see what it was going to be. Going back and dealing with like all of these memories of like these classes and these teachers who I think in a way kind of failed me, you know? And so I went back and just kind of ran around all of these schools.
I love it.
And kind of like reclaimed these spaces for myself, not as sites of trauma or bad memories or frustration, but like a place that for better or for worse formed me and influenced who I am today, and went back and kind of ran around them as an act of like, I did this, you know, I did it.
It's brilliant.
That's awesome.
You're so cool.
How did you feel afterwards?
Yeah,
I mean, I felt great. Like I went to Loyola for freshman year of high school for just that 1 year, and that was probably one of the toughest years in school for me for a lot of different reasons. But I remember seeing a bumper sticker on a car, a Loyola High School bumper sticker, and all of the years in seeing sweatshirts on kids walking around LA or the bumper stickers, I remember feeling like, oh, like fuck that school, you know. But then after running that lap for that 1 year that I was there, I saw a bumper sticker maybe 2 months after that on the freeway and smiled, you know?
Oh, wow.
Like that school.
You're changing your own memories.
Yeah. It feels, when I think about Loyola, it feels different in my body now because I did that lap and like dealt with the shit that I needed to deal with.
That's so
amazing. I think I'm going to do that to all the places I used to work at.
Good idea.
Run around some places where I had shitty ass jobs, with shitty people I worked with who were like out to get me, and let just run around those places.
Sweat it out.
Yeah. I think I'm going to do that.
Yeah. Create new memories in old places.
Because that's really amazing.
Exactly.
Yeah. I really like that idea. That's really cool. We've been told that you are really into astrology.
Yes.
And so we want to talk about astrology right now.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, let's go.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm ready.
How so?
Please. I mean, well, I feel like what's funny about astrology, especially like, you know, now that there's like an Instagram account for like every sign, you know, there's probably like 300 for every sign. Most people just know about their sign, which is like a, you know, really funny part of the sort of like astrological moment. But I think in so many ways, the more people that I meet, I took a little staycation with a friend of mine who's visiting from out of town, and we went up to Topanga. And the first thing that we did when we got to this beautiful house, I immediately changed and jumped in the pool, and he started cleaning around the house, and he's like, if this isn't a Virgo Cancer combo, I don't know what is.
You
know?
Sure. Yeah.
I was just like, where's the water? I want it. And he's like organizing everything. It's just like when I'm
a Cancer, my wife's a Virgo.
No way.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I'm a Pisces.
Oh, so. Watery.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is, it's funny because like, of course it's not tried and true across the board, but like there are certain traits that I think just makes sense. The more people I meet and the deeper that I get into thinking about like how we move through the world, you know, there has to be something to the fact that like if the moon is strong enough to affect the waters and tides, like why can't it do the same thing to like the waters in my body, you know? Like I don't
It
just kind of makes sense to me.
That's you cool. And I are moon children.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I'm a fish.
And you're a fish.
A couple
fish. Do you read about astrology a lot?
I mean, I don't get like too, I'm not going to take like a course, or maybe actually, I don't know, maybe I will. I don't read too much, but I do kind of dip into, you know, CoStar apps and like the weekly astrological, like what's trine conjunct. I don't know all too deep, but I did have a reading with someone last year on my birthday that was kind of mind-blowing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
With an astrologist?
Mm-hmm.
Astrologer?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's really cool.
Yeah. Wait, so what's your... astrology for you?
For me?
Yeah.
Well, I'm just... I'm a Pisces, but...
do you guys...
My rising sign is Krispy Kreme donuts, I'm pretty sure. I don't know. I don't know a great deal about my astrology, but what I do know is that I am typical in some senses of a Pisces because I'm very, very emotional, and mm-hmm. I listen... I'm a good listener. And I watch a lot of TV. So, you know.
What's that about Pisces?
I'm pretty sure. I don't know a lot about it. I don't know a lot about
A good listener.
yeah.
I'm chill. Likes to watch a lot of TV.
Yes.
That's the rising.
Very open. I'm a very open
Or is that like
book.
Your Tinder account? Whatever.
Hey, look. That's between you and I.
yeah, with me, like, I was really into it for a while. Not like so crazy into it, but I would you know, be interested in a girl or like her, and I would be like, oh, and then I find out what her sign is, and I would like go to the bookstore and like see, like, read about like how compatible we'd be, you know, if we got into this relationship that would never happen.
Yeah, dude.
But yeah, you know, I recognize that, you know, I have very specific traits that line up with what a Cancer is. I'm moody, I can get depressed easily, I can go into a shell easily. But I'm also very passionate, you know. It could be a life of a party. I'm very concerned about other people,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, yeah, I look at that and I'm like, oh, okay. And sometimes I'll read something that'll be way off. I'm like, that's not even me. And I'll read something that's spot on. I'm like, that's crazy how that can be.
It is really wild.
Yeah.
I think it use it more as like a guide.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that makes sense.
One other thing I wanted to ask you, like when you're doing your performance art, has anyone famous ever walked in and you're like, oh, fuck, it's George Clooney. Do I just stand here and how am I going to react?
That's funny.
Or is it Steve Glickman?
Okay, this...
like you're just standing there like, oh, fuck, it's, you know...
Okay, you're going to think I'm totally insane, maybe, for
Please.
This. But there was one moment where because your mind goes to... a place that you can't even imagine when you're doing something like this. It just wanders for hours. During the performance...
Are you thinking about, like, what am I going to do tonight when I get home? And, like, groceries?
Everything. And, all of it.
I got to binge this on Netflix
Yeah,
tomorrow.
It's, like, the most absurd thoughts with the most, like, logical, and they're all mixed together. So I was lying on the platform of the roller coaster at the Studio Museum in 2016. My mind got in this wave where I was like, oh no, like this is the day that like Harry Styles is going to come to the museum. Like I know it. I feel it. And I got stuck.
That's so random.
It's yes, exactly.
Wow.
I know. And so I'm laying on this platform and I'm like, what am I going to do when he gets here? Do I break? Do I stand up and say, hey, you like, love your work, man. Like that new album's just like.
Harry Styles.
Yeah, it's like. it's like. I know it's so ridiculous, but this is.
Well, we have a treat for you. Harry Styles is here.
Right, come in the booth, Harry.
I love him so much. But okay, so no, the answer to that is no, but I am definitely prepared for for something.
Wow.
Yeah. So you waited all day and he never fucking showed up.
He didn't, but then after a few hours of like coming in and out of that thought, I was like, okay, EJ, like you have maybe 1 hour left of this and I'm so hungry, what am I gonna eat tonight?
Uh-huh.
And like, so that's where it ended up.
I was hoping you were going to tell me he walked in.
Harry Styles.
And then miraculously he walks in, you know, you get up, he says he's a big fan.
That's like, the way to end
yeah,
that show.
Yeah.
EJ, it is an honor to have you. Thank
yes,
you
thank
again.
Thank you so much.
For doing
very
this.
Much.
Thank you're
thank
the greatest,
this
buddy.
Is great. Thanks so much.
Can't wait to see what you do next. You bet.
Never Surrender is produced by Western Sound. Executive producers are Jack Herguth, Stephen Kramer Glickman, and Ben Adair. Producers are Sabrina Fang and Cameron Kell. Music by Hannes Brown.
On social media, you can check us out on Instagram at Never Surrender Pod, on Twitter at Surrender Pod, and on Facebook at Never Surrender Podcast. You can also email us at neversurrenderpodcast@gmail.com to share your own stories about how you struggled, failed, and ultimately never surrendered.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.